As it turns out, Mount Kilimanjaro was not Wi-Fi enabled, so I had to spend 2 weeks in Tanzania talking to the people on my trip. Welcome back to the third consecutive episode of CivCast. We are recording on Monday, April 30th. I am Dan, and my co-host is Wouter. And today we have a bunch of stuff to talk about. We are going to talk about our very well-received report back section, which was pertaining to our going in-depth on a specific Civ in the game. This week it was Tamar and Georgia, which I had a ton of fun with. I had a great game with her, actually. And I'm stoked to share some words about it. We're going to talk a little bit about the religious system in the game, go a bit more in-depth on it, since I know that that's something we both, obviously, the Georgia game interacted with. We'll talk about what our new report back is going to be. We'll share some of your experiences that you shared on the Reddit, which is reddit.com/r/civcast, and you definitely always should share those. We will weave them onto the episode as best we can. And yeah, I don't know, Bob's your uncle after that. Wouter, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks, Dan. How are you?
Good. I'm well. Yeah, you had a good week?
Yeah, I actually had. It was a pretty fun-packed week. We celebrated King's Day in the Netherlands, which is always a festivity. They actually went to my city this year.
Oh, nice. What were some of the activities that you guys were doing?
Like what always happens is like they take a walk through the city where the city can show off some of its more like cultural stuff and everything like that. For example, I live in a huge student city, so we had all the student associations sing together a song that was very popular here local, which is literally about the city of Groningen. So that was interesting.
Awesome. And like stroopwafels for everybody?
I mean, stroopwafels are always a thing we eat, so that's nothing special. But as a good Dutchman, we do a lot of heavy drinking, especially the night before, and of course on the day itself as well.
Okay, as you do. I mean, the king wouldn't have it any other way, right?
Exactly.
Right on, buddy. We gotta find a way to sneak the Netherlands into our report back one of these times. I don't think they're going to be this week, but over the next few weeks, I definitely want to get a game in with Wilhelmina. Yes. So the current king, is the current king a descendant of Wilhelmina?
He is, actually. It's Wilhelmina is his grandmother.
Oh, cool. Right on. Well, then, little historical tidbits all over the place for you guys here. Okay, so why don't we zero the discussion in on our experiences with Georgia this week? So why don't you kick it off? The report back section, and by the way, I meant to mention this at the start of the episode. If you have an email, please email us, civcastpodcast@gmail.com. We had an email this week, and if that's your preferred method of feedback, that's great. Please be sure to send us that. But Wouter, you know, we started off this segment 2 weeks ago with our Nubia game. But this week I felt like I had a much stronger game. And I felt like I had a much more enjoyable game. I don't necessarily know if that's because I prefer Georgia to Nubia or if just the game itself was more enjoyable. But what was your experience like? What was your map type? Set the stage for us and then roll it out.
So I played on one of the highest difficulties, just the one below Deity. I believe it's Immortal. I wanted to play Georgia as a religious game, which is a little bit difficult. But I managed to grab a religion, Zoroastrianism, because we talked about it, I believe, last time as well, that would be a cool thing to do as Georgia. And I had a pretty decent game. My map type is my preferred one, Pangaea. And I had Indonesia really close next to me, same as Scythia, but I managed to expand quite aggressively in the beginning, forward settling both of them a little bit, managed to keep them friendly pretty much the entire game. Only later game I got into some conflict with Indonesia because I started converting their cities. But beyond that, I coasted to a pretty cool victory. I really made use of the ability that Georgia has, that if a city-state is following your religion, you get two envoys if you send one. So I made a point of only sending envoys to city-states that were following my religion to get the maximum of that bonus. And that worked pretty well. One of the things that I was aiming for in the game, since I knew I was going for religious victory, was for the achievement where you have all the city-states following your religion. I thought that was going to be a problem, but then I had Germany in my game. And Germany managed to take out quite a lot of city-states, and in the end, when I won the game, there were only 5 of them left. So that wasn't that hard, and I got the achievement for that one.
Yeah, process of elimination, thanks to Frederick, then.
I joked about it last episode that one way to get that achievement easily is taking out the other city-states. I didn't attack one city-state. Germany just swept a lot of them away.
Yeah. That's helpful. I guess another way to do it would be to just make sure that you only have like 2 city states in the game. But, you know, you want it to be genuine. You want it to be a legit challenge. So I respect
exactly.
that.
I mean, and Germany also got some help from America later on. They also decided to conquer at least one city state that I remember. But the AI was a little bit aggressive. And even while I was converting city states, I saw them still trying to conquer some. But by then I already got the achievement, so they could conquer away as far as I was concerned. And I had one of the city states centered in my empire, like covered around with my city, so I knew that one was safe for the rest of the game at least.
Yeah, for sure. Well, they went just buck wild with the city states. How many did you have? Did you start with, since you had 8 on that size map, did you start with 12 city states in the game?
I started with the normal amount, and he ended up with 4 left when I won the game. So I'm not exactly sure what on the standard map the amount of city states is, if it is like 8 or 10, but somewhere around that range.
Yeah, it's 12 if you have a standard size map game.
So oh, 12 that's, even. That's, then they really went buck wild on them.
Yeah, they did. Absolutely. So that achievement you're talking about is Holy Righteous Queen Tamar. It's only on Steam at 0.6%. And yeah, it's as Tamar have every city state in the game follow the religion you founded. I'm close to, I haven't finished my game, but I'm really close. And I'm close to having that achievement. I think I'm only 2 city states away. And of course, the pain in the ass being I didn't play on Pangaea. So I have to keep sailing my apostles and my missionaries over to other continents to re-acclimatize people in my religion, so that's a bit of a pain in the butt. Tamar's other achievement that we talked about, too. Did you have another achievement? I'm trying to remember.
I don't remember.
No, I don't think so. I think that's the only one. That's yeah. Right, yeah. Her other achievement is just win a game with her, which actually fewer people have done than the city state one, which is kind of ironic. Okay, so, you know, let's talk about the religious mechanic then. So, on Immortal, you're successful at getting a new religion founded, which is, I mean, it's a challenge. I find it's a challenge on basically anything above Emperor, or Emperor even and above. What did you roll with in terms of your Pantheon beliefs and in terms of your founder beliefs and so on and so forth, and what was your logic behind that?
So the Pantheon that I chose was harvesting a resource or removing a feature gives fate equal to the other guild's quantity. That way, to ramp up a little bit of the fate production, if I remove some resources to push out settlers quickly in the beginning of the game, which I did. I just wanted to settle a lot of cities, build holy sites in all of those cities, so to get a very nice amount of fate production going on. And I was once again really lucky. I got early in the game a relic, and I decided, well, maybe I can do like a relic game where I will build the Mont Saint-Michel, let some of my apostles die, get a couple of extra relics going on and everything like that. So mm-hmm. I went with the reliquaries faith as well, where relics have triple yield of both faith and tourism. And then nice. I went with my standard order for the rest of the faith. I get holy orders for missionaries and apostles that are 30% cheaper to purchase. Pilgrimage that gives +2 faith for every city following this religion in other civilizations, the city state, which since I am literally pushing my religion to other cities anyway, I might as well get like a nice buff and become stronger the further out I get. And I went with mosques, which gives missionaries and apostles +1 spread and allows the construction of mosques. Combining that together with Moksha, the guru governor, with his very powerful ability of patron saints. Apostles trained in the city received one extra promotion. I was able to snack away a couple of times because the city state of what is it called again? It's a city, I believe it's Yerevan, and it allows you to choose whatever promotion you want on your apostle. So I had that one under my control. Got two promotions, and I usually went with the promotions that eliminate 75% of the other religion, and then triple strength in another civilization. And with that, I was easily able to insta-convert a lot of cities and stuff like that. And that was that made my trip throughout the continent relatively easy, and converting first the persons who didn't get her own religion, and after that I had to become the bully and start converting the other ones that had a religion, like Indonesia, Poland, and America.
So who was your big competitor for Hearts and Minds on the continent?
The biggest problem probably was America. Good thing for me, it was all the way on the other side of the continent. And not sharing a same sea with me. But they were quite active in trying to push out their religion, Protestantism, around the world. But I had already converted Scythia to my cause, and Germany as well. And with the passive influence of my religion, they already were starting to get weakened. And I could just push in with a couple of well-placed apostles and sweep them away with my religion as well. The hardest one was Poland, because they were far away and had to sail across the ocean to get there. And but in the end, that wasn't that big of a problem either. They only had a couple of cities, so, and you need to convert half of them for the win.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I had a couple of cities that I interacted with too that only had three or four cities. And so, you know, you just, you end up really quickly kind of washing over their shores there, and it ended up being pretty easy. Did you run into any significant religious combat? Because in this game, I definitely saw a lot of religious combat, and I was able to kind of gear some strategy around that.
I actually did, because Indonesia, while not pushing their religion so much to other people, was battling me, because Scythia was south of her, while Scythia was east for me. We were kind of both trying to get Scythia on our religious side, so I had to do quite a lot of combat. But once again, since I had Yerevan under my control, I was also able to pick the plus 20 power in theological debates, and I really just murdered her apostles, which made spreading it my religion easier for me. So I did see quite some combat, but it was really one-sided, and I kind of kicked ass.
Militant Georgian Zoroastrianism, that's really historically appropriate, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good stuff, buddy. Okay, so you were victorious on, do you remember which turn?
I have it up right now. It was turn 181 in 1280.
And on a mortal, you're just schooling me right now, man. Well done. Good job.
Thank you.
Good job. Good job. So I had an enjoyable experience with it. It really was a super fun game that I had. The map type, I actually think I went, I'm trying to remember, that's the one thing I can't really remember. I think I went fractal, pretty sure I went fractal, because we ended up on a couple different islands. I might have just gone with continents, but anyway, I shared an island with Cleopatra and Gilgamesh, and neither of them really prioritized religion. Cleopatra did prioritize being a pain in the ass in terms of spreading cities really close to my borders, so I appreciated that. But I found it Eastern Orthodoxy pretty quick. The beliefs I went with, so for my, I kind of screwed up with my pantheon belief. I thought I was going to go in one direction, and I didn't end up going in that direction at all. So I went with, and I think like the one that I really wanted was taken. So I ended up going with Divine Spark, you know, Divine Spark, the one where you get great people. And I leaned pretty heavily into science as well. So I by no means min-maxed this game. I tried to, you know, advance my science in concert with my religion, but eventually I just kind of dropped off the wayside. I did get a lot of great scientists as a result of Divine Spark, which is great, but it ended up being kind of useless, to be honest, and I learned my lesson from that one. I think really that one's probably better used for a culture coordinated victory. The one thing I really liked, and I knew early on in the game that I was going to be playing a really kind of Cleopatra tried to attack me twice, and I staved her off really quickly. And I realized that, you know, Tamar, with her unique building improvement, which is the walls called the Kishni or something like that. Where is it?
I don't remember what they're right called actually, but they are called the Tshike in Tshike.
Thank you. Perfect. And those are really fantastic, it should be said. But that combined with just me having my back up against the sea made me realize that I was going to have just kind of like a defensive game where I was really comfortable building up six cities, holding back, but spreading the religion obviously pretty militantly. So with all those things in mind, I went with the worship belief of Dar-Emer. Dar-Emer is +3 faith +1 additional faith for each era since constructed or last repaired. And I rush Dar-Emer's in most of my cities. I got them in 5 of my 6 cities. And I mean, I got at least through 3 eras, I think, since I constructed them, and none of them were attacked or sieged or anything like that. So, you know, that accumulates, I think. And if you think that you're going to be playing a longer religious game, like one maybe you have 12 opponents or something like that, or a lot of city states, or it seems contentious, I feel like Dar-Emer would be a good one, because then by the time, you know, maybe the modern era rolls along, you're getting, each of them are giving you maybe +4 or +5 extra faith. And I mean, mosques is really helpful, obviously, the +1 spread religion charge. But I ended up getting the promotional belief, I think it's called Orator, that allows them to get 2 extra spreads, apostles to get 2 extra spreads for most of my apostles anyway. And I meant to ask you, that's randomized, right? The upgrades that they get when they're spawned?
Yeah, and I believe there's still something wrong with it, that you keep getting the same ones over and over if you haven't like picked that one for a while, for example. I'm not sure if that's a feature or a bug or whatever, but it's still a thing that happens. And that's why I was really glad I had Yerevan and I could just choose my promotions.
Yeah, fair enough. And yeah, so I keyed in very specifically on the Orator promotion, which gives you 2 extra spreads for your apostles. Moving on from that, my founder belief, I was debating cross-cultural dialogue initially, because like I said, I was going for science, but I mean, the one that made the most sense is pilgrimage, which is +2 faith for every city following this religion and other civilizations. And since Cleopatra had something like 9 cities, I think, and I evangelized them peacefully, it should be said, really quickly, like, I think just coming out of the classical era, that was hugely beneficial. And then Gilgamesh fell under the sword of God really quickly as well. So I think really early on, after I evangelized that belief, it was really, really helpful. For my enhancer belief, what did I go with? I went with Inherent Preachers, which is religion spreads to cities 30% farther away, because I was on a bunch of islands and I had Norway and Nubia and France and the Netherlands, you know, it's significant ways away from me. And so I kind of realized early on that I was going to need to make sure that my pressure and my spread was there. And the last promotion I went with was the one that gets you gurus. So, you know, gurus, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're the healer. They're the healer religious unit. And this was actually kind of fun. So with gurus, there is an achievement that I didn't really know existed, or I looked it up after. And it's called Raid Healer, and it's with a guru, heal 7 religious units with 1 action. And so it was actually really quite fantastic. So I was looking up a bunch of the different achievements and such. I found that Raid Healer was an available achievement. I was like, oh, I have. It was really cool. So you square them up all around the guru, and the guru gets 3 charges of heal, and it's really not super dramatic at all, actually, because the guru, right, when you press heal, it doesn't really do any action, and it just heals them. So it's not super dramatic or anything. It's kind of a more hidden one. As I found a lot of achievements that I was looking at, the really clever ones are pretty hidden. But that's kind of a neat one. I don't think, the mechanisms to go with the city-state spread one. I had 12 city-states as well. One of them was like really secluded on like a corner island, and it was behind the walls of Nubia. And Nubia was the one other civ that was charging forward with their religion. And any time that was sending apostles into her area, she was attacking you right away. But, you know, I haven't won yet. Just I'm on turn 254, and Nubia is the only holdout right now. So she's got a lot of pressure on her cities, but she's strong. She's definitely the strongest civ on the map, probably even stronger than me, to be honest, if I'm looking at her civ spread right now. I'm playing on Emperor difficulty. And it's going to be a chore, I think, for sure, because anytime I go into even her satellite cities, she kicks the crap out of my apostles. So I think I'm going to have to build up a little army of God and send them over there. And maybe forcibly do it. But anyway, I'm having a lot of fun with this game, I guess is the point that I'm trying to make here. Going really hard in a religious victory requires a lot of micromanaging, obviously. There's some turns where I would forget to pump out an apostle or a missionary because I would be prioritizing other things, or I'd be focused in other areas. And that's probably one thing that I noticed and would like an improvement on, I guess. I mean, it prompts you on the right side with an icon that says you have enough, but like most people, I ignore those icons for the most part. But curious your thoughts on whether something like an automatic production queue for something like an apostle would be helpful, or if I'm just kind of, you know, asking for them to baby me a little too much when it comes to the production of those units.
I think that is a little bit too much babying, because especially like you will run into the issues, at least I know I will, where an apostle gets pumped out and I'm like, no, I didn't want that. I actually want something else. I wanted to buy a mosque with that fade in this new city that I just built, which is on the frontier from where I want to push out apostles now instead of the city where it just popped out of. I think it will bring me into more trouble than it's worth at the moment, especially also because I like to send my apostles in groups, so I don't want them pushed out every time there is available. That way they can travel in like defensive packs and fend off any enemy apostles that roam around, or enemy missionaries, and just kill them and gain the nice boost out of that. I find that if I send my apostles out alone, then they tend to die before they reach where I want them to be.
Yeah, that was a lesson hard learned early on in my scraps with Nubia in this game, is that, you know, the level of aggression from civs, and she's very clearly also, or at least the beginning of the game before I started to dominate, she clearly was also going for a religious victory, because she was even sending her apostles over to me. So, yeah, you're right. I think that, you know, the militancy of it and the aggression, there is an innate level of aggression there for the AI on, you know, the religious combat for other civs that are looking in that direction is there. And I think that's good. I enjoyed the religious combat in this game. I was having a lot of fun with it. Not just the fact that, like, it looks neat. And I think it does look kind of neat and clever with the lightning bolts and everything. But I also like, and it is, it's really cool. I like what they've done with that. They haven't made it particularly violent. They've made it almost, like, metaphorical, which is neat.
I like to think of them having cool, like, rap battles with thunder and lightning and stuff like that. And when somebody get dissed so hard, they just be like, I'm out, yo, and then they're gone. That's how you beat them.
Ain't nobody prepared for Vautier's Georgian Zoroastrianism, though.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but that's, I mean, you can't really rhyme anything with Zoroastrianism. And if you can, you really should win your rap battle, quite frankly.
And apparently my apostles can.
Apparently they can. Good stuff. But, you know, the promotion system being keyed into religious combat is great. I also found this one when I went theocracy. And I forgot to mention that. I did go theocracy. So I went oligarchy into monarchy into theocracy. And theocracy is obviously, I'm assuming you probably went in that direction as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's pretty much a must-have for a religious victory, in my opinion, especially in higher difficulties.
Yeah, and it was great, actually. Like, theocracy... and we can talk in a later episode about the government system, and it had faults and everything like that. But I mean, it's fun and it's neat. Theocracy, strategy wise, is absolutely a must if you're looking for a religious victory. I'll just read you out some of the effects. It gives you 2 military cards, 2 economic, 1 diplo, and 1 wild card. It's a nice little spread there. The effects means you can buy land combat units with faith, all units plus 5 religious strength and theological combat. Then post rise and fall, you get plus 5 religious strength and theological combat, plus 5 faith per citizens and cities with governors, and a 15% discount on purchases with faith. But you also get legacy bonus of discount on faith purchases, 15% plus 1 for every 50 on a standard speed, and then you get a religious combat bonus as well. So yeah, you know, it was a must, and rolling it out was an easy choice for me. So yeah, you know, I had a fun time. I really did with religious combat. With Tamar herself, in terms of the Civ, I'm gonna in a second here about to get into some of the report backs from a couple of the folks who shared with us on the board. CK, the wall, which gives you lower production cost, but it gives you plus 3 faith, plus 3 housing under monarchy, and plus 50 under defense strength. It helps, right? I mean, obviously it helps with a religious victory to get extra faith from your walls. That's really unique. Plus 3 tourism, yeah, as well, should be noted. That's obviously beneficial. And I built them in every city, and it was great. They don't really look like much. So that part was a little disappointing. They're just kind of weird colored walls, green and kind of a copper color, which is meh.
And it's also one of the few actually sprites that are on the map that I was also not really a big like, oh, this is cool. No, it's one of the few that are actually not that amazing. Like, I love the way that walls are represented on the map in general, with like literally seeing them build up, for example. Even if you go to higher level walls, you go to like the medieval walls and stuff like that, while you're building it, you will see gaps in between that they're slowly being filled. I love that detail, but yeah, I'm really disappointed with the unique walls that Georgia got, because I think they could have made it a bit better.
And I think I feel the same way about China's Great Wall, quite frankly. I think that walls just look kind of silly, I guess you could say, in this game. And that might have something to do with the proportions of the cities. And when you really zoom in on it, they actually look proportional to the cities. Perhaps it's just like the art style and stuff that, you know, the sprites for walls just don't really resonate with me. And the one for Great Wall, like I said, doesn't either. Curious your thoughts on the Kev Sewer. I only built a couple of them, and I didn't really end up using them because I wasn't really in, obviously, any sort of domination play. But also, Cleopatra was easily subdued with archers and warriors for me. So I built a couple of Kev Sewers to look at them. And also, it should be noted, the medieval unit and military tactics wasn't anything near what I was prioritizing. So I basically had to go back in the tree in order to get the tech I needed for them. They look neat on the map. That sprite looks cool, but I didn't end up using them. What about you?
I actually never researched military tactics. It's dead-end tech. Doesn't give me anything. I'm not really interested in pikemen either. And the Kessur is, to me, definitely not worth it in building either. They have a strength of 40, movement of 2. They're a melee unit. For example, the swordsman has a strength of 36 and a movement of 2, while costing half the production, only 90 compared to 180 for the Kefsur. The ability of having plus 7 combat strength when fighting on hill terrain and no movement penalty on hill terrain is just not worth it for me to specifically go to military tactics and spend twice the amount of production on building them. Also because I never really did any offensive war, all the wars that I did were really defensive, hiding behind my walls, bombing them with some archers and stuff like that. There was just no reason for me to go to them. The only reason I could think is if you really lack iron, for example, in the game, you can't build any swordsmen, then you might actually have some use for them. But beyond that, not really. I find them really bad, actually.
Really bad. Interesting. That's strong language. And I wouldn't disagree, to be fair.
They are so expensive. The 180 production is just too much for a melee class unit, in my opinion, in this way, compared to like what their melee strength is. So you can have two swordsmen for the same price. The maintenance will be one higher though, because the swordsman maintenance is two, while their unit maintenance is three. But you can have two swordsmen rocking around on the field with pretty much the exact same combat strength, unless they're standing on a hill. And that's just worth more to me.
Yeah. So would you agree then, and it's fair to say that George's strengths lie in the Civ's innate abilities and Tamar's leader ability, and not its unique infrastructure or unit?
Well, I really like the unique walls for the freight production. That is actually a really huge boon. Also, they are a bit cheaper, which is always a great thing, and really leads into like the defensive play that you can do well as with Georgia that way. But yeah, beyond that, her Tamar's unique ability is definitely where the power lays from apart as well. Plus, of course, that you get the Golden Age bonus, that if you have a Golden Age, you also get to make the reap the benefits of the non-Golden Age part of the thing you choose.
Yeah, and we haven't mentioned that. And I mean, I used that to stack Era score pretty quickly. I got the Golden Age. I got a regular age belief where it's like when you convert a city for the first time, you get plus two era score, and I can't remember what the Golden Age one I did this time, and I was able to just stack Golden Ages. What about you?
I have not been in anything else but a Golden Age.
There you go. There you go. It's easy with her, quite frankly.
And yeah.
It's a little OP, but I don't really know how you can nerf it.
It is a really, really powerful ability. The higher difficulties, it becomes more difficult, of course, but chaining Golden Ages becomes a lot easier. Well, I mean, I have only gone until like turn 181, because the more Golden Ages that you have, the harder it becomes to get another Golden Age, because the requirements just go up. You need more era score after each Golden Age that you've had. And eventually, I probably, if I keep chaining them, I will get to a point where I just am not able to make enough era score to actually gain a Golden Age. I believe the last age, I was very close to actually not getting a Golden Age again. But then I believe I converted a couple of cities, and then I actually got the Golden Age again, because most of the
people have done.
Oh yeah, no, they would be like, are we not always in a golden age? Is this what other people always feel like?
Why are we not golden?
Exactly. But I went with most of the time that I had the chance, and I believe that's pretty much most of the game, with Exodus of the Evangelist Golden Age thing, which give extra movement and extra charges to my apostles, and which also gives me game plus two era score each time you convert a city to your final religion for the first time, which just keeps it keeps giving me all these things that I want, what I'm going for anyway, and that's in my opinion the key for a good Golden Age strategy. Pick things that you're already going to do. Don't go out of your way to do other things, because usually that just doesn't help.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, a good Golden Age strategy early on was to clear barbarian encampments and outposts and so forth, because that gives you, I think, plus three, maybe plus two, I can't remember. But
it's a plus three if it's close by one.
Yeah, it's a huge boon to any sort of era score. But yeah, it's obviously an OP ability. And then her leader bonus for the World Kingdom and Faith, plus 100% for 10 after declaring, plus 100% Faith, sorry, for 10 turns after declaring a protectorate war. I never used that, never declared a protectorate war, but you were to, I could see that as being great. But the part of it I did use was each envoy you sent to a city-state of your majority religion counts as two envoys. I had a really cool city-state suzerain bonus deck, so you had Candy. And Candy's suzerain bonus is a weird one. It's every time you find a natural wonder, you get a relic that spawns in your capital. And I mean, we must have been living in Candyland, because I found, like, I maxed out my relics by like the Renaissance. It was great. I found four natural wonders, boom, 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 and the relics just spawned in my capital, and that was awesome. So, and a big part of that was me being able to send two envoys instead of one early on once I converted Candy. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's really great. Okay. Did you get lucky that you found a natural wonder already when you were researching, astrology?
No, I didn't. But the nearest Dash of Wonder was like pretty far north on the continent, so I wasn't so lucky.
I was really lucky. Like only 6 miles away from my capital, I had the Giant's Causeway spawn near me, which was also the direction that I first scouted. So I started researching astrology, and I immediately got the Eureka pretty much for it. It was amazing. It helped a lot.
Did you get Stonehenge?
I did not go for Stonehenge because I didn't have any stone near my capital, so I was unable to do so. But I was able to found the first religion in the game, which was really powerful.
Nice. And I found the second one, but it ended up working out in the end. I am going to hop probably on this afternoon / this evening to finish this game because I want to win a game through. It's been a crap ton of fun. So overall, Wouter, this has been a really good discussion. Before I get you to put Tamara in a tier, why don't we really quickly read the two report back subreddit comments that we got? I'll read the one from Marino and you read the one from VectorCat. Does that sound good?
Sounds perfect.
Cool. Okay, I'll read Marino's. So Marino says, Marino 1914, actually finished a game with her yesterday, hadn't played with her, and was going for the achievement of having every CS follow my religion. Emperor, small map, mixed continents, detailed worlds mod, and standard everything. Against 5 AI, which was focused on religion, this was an easy game. Rushed Mahabodhi Temple, converted 2 neighbors without using all charges of the Free Apostles, and with Magnus plus Goddess of the Harvest, had more than enough faith to buy 8 to 10 apostles and 4 to 6 missionaries. Finished at turn 145, so very impressive, and had to play 5 more turns to get the achievement. Regarding her strengths, I don't believe they are anything worth mentioning. 2 golden ages in a row, both with the religion dedication, of course, in my opinion, a bottom tier Civ. So a skeptic. Marino is a skeptic. And I mean, look, we like the abilities, but we're not crazy. Well, okay, and the TK is good. I'll acknowledge you that. But I guess the unique unit is pretty bottom tier. We both agree. But to put her in bottom tier, I think, is a little harsh, I guess.
I think so as well. But I will reserve my opinion on that when I place her into a tier later.
Okay, sounds good. Go for VectorCat.
All right, so VectorCat was a huge fan of Georgia. For this report, for this week's report back, I set up a game on a large fractal map with only 8 players. And then he cranked up the city-state count to 24. And carnage ensued. 24 city-states, that's immense amounts. Scythia, Greece, both factions, so he had both of the Greece in there, which I haven't seen, but then again, I never play on a large map. And the Aztecs brutalized the city-state. Even with all this city-state domination going on, I never had the conditions right to declare a protectorate war in this game. I had the same experience. I see a lot of city-state disappear, but never able to do a protectorate war, unfortunately. I was allied with everyone except for Percules for most mid and late game, so I was able to take advantage of the 100% fate bonus after declaring a protectorate war. I must admit that Georgia's strength can be situational, and this may knock them out of the god tier status, but I love playing as Samar. The Kestrel is great, and chaining Golden Age is really beneficial. I find it interesting that he does like their unit.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. 3 in a row in this game before victory at turn 149. Not too shabby on a large mob on the AT. Definitely not.
Oh, come on, VectorCat. That's more than not too shabby, dude.
That's actually pretty good. The Golden Age buffs helped me make up for the distance my missionary apostles had to travel to convert Ardaceus, which is definitely true. Mm-hmm. So he went with Choral Music, Pilgrimage, Mosque, and Burial Ground, and Earth Goddess for his beliefs. The Moksha on the right side of the promotion tree, other governors were the Magnus, of course, and Renya.
The Moksha is the diplomat one, right?
Yeah, and Moksha is the guru one.
Yeah.
And the right side of the promotion tree is also the part that I went down. The only major religious competition came from Scythia and the Khmer. Also, Eagle Wars and Deity are no joke. They really are no joke. They hurt, he says, and that's definitely true. One early war was definitely enough. Worked hard to build relations with Montezuma, which eventually turned into a religious alliance. That's awesome. Poland, Australia, and Arabia are still my religious favorites, but I think Georgia is a really strong and interesting addition to the game.
Yeah, and she's played in a unique fashion, I think. So, that's a really good report back, and VectorCAD is a really impressive achievement.
Definitely. Well done, VectorCAD.
But definitely contrasting opinions there between Marino and VectorCAD. And, I guess this is a sieve that, for me, I would put definitely on the stronger side of the ledger, but I wouldn't rush back to play her. She wouldn't be my first choice in, say a multiplayer game that I was really keen on or something like that. She has her strengths and she has her specific way of playing, and we both sound like we played it in a similar way. Definitely there's areas where I can see some of the other sides, particularly think about Poland and Arabia, as out-muscling her for religion. So I don't have a tier list, but if I did, I'd put her maybe second or third ring of the ladder. What about you?
Georgia was actually the first Civ that I played with the Rise and Fall expansion, I believe. And the reason why is because of her ability to do Golden Ages with normal dedication. Yeah. And I think that ability is by itself that good that I would still place her not on an S tier or something like that, but on an A tier list. She's not God tier, but she's just one step below that, because that is such an amazing, powerful thing. You will be able to get Golden Age, because most civilizations I will drop to Dark Age just so that I get the -5 for next Golden Ages, get some of the Dark Age policies and everything like that. Where Tamar, I just keep chaining those Golden Ages, no matter what the difficulty is set on. And that by itself is really, really powerful. Like VectorCAD said, having that ability to have your apostles and missionaries and everything get +2 movement for pretty much a large part of the game is insanely powerful. If I were in a normal age, it would have taken me a lot longer to actually convert other people, which gave them time to build more missionaries and everything like that. It is really, really, really powerful to have these Golden Age change going on. And if you are in a little bit of luck and actually play that way, with all the constant Golden Ages, you will be able to steal away cities from enemy empires as well. If they go into a Dark Age, you go to a Golden Age, use some little bit of magic with an entertainment district or something like that, and you can literally steal away their cities. That is really powerful, and I think that just by itself makes her A tier. The rest of her abilities aren't amazing. I like the walls for defensive gameplay, which is really well suited for, and go settle in, turtle in at home and spread your legion far and wide, but it's not enough to actually go operative or anything like that, especially because the rest around it is not that amazing either. But a definite A tier for me, and definitely not a bottom tier.
Good stuff. Really glad to hear that. So guys, we encourage you with report back section, we encourage you to go to the subreddit and post your experiences. We will share them. They will be the impetus of our discussion. We'll do the same for this week. It's just a really good way for us to go in depth, I think, and it really helps guide our discussion in a unique direction. And overall, with Tamar, we both like her, but obviously experiences vary from game to game. I do know it's pretty situational. So when I read what Marino said there, I can definitely empathize with some of that. And the religious mechanic in the game was a lot of fun to interact with. So overall, really positive experience this past week. Valtteri, for this week's report back, I know before the episode I said that I wanted to do Alexander, but as we've been talking, I kind of want to change my thought process here. I want to go with a Civ, either Rise and Fall or Vanilla or just an add-on Civ, whatever, your choice, that we can focus in on a cultural victory with, which is not a direction I go very often. So who should we go with?
Okay, so a cultural victory Civ, the first one that pops into my mind is the Congo.
Okay.
They are really cool for that. Let me think if there is one that might be on a similar level. Pedro also is pretty good because he gets the bonus of 20% reduction refund after he buys a great person.
What about your girl, Wilhelmina?
Yeah, I mean, she's okay at it, but not that great. Another contender would be England, but I would rather reserve that for maybe after the spring patch comes out, where she gets a little bit of an extra buff again. But okay. How about we try the Congo and see if we can do some cool cultural stuff with that? I really like the Congo. I haven't played with them for a while. I like the Mbanza, so I'm really curious.
Yeah, man, let's do it. Let's play a Congo game. I haven't played with them in ages either, at least since like the first couple months of release. So that's fantastic. We will do a Congo game with Report Back, and like last week, we will have the subreddit post up. I'll put it up later tonight or tomorrow. So get your Congo games in there. Share your experiences with us. The Congolese achievement that I'm looking at right now, there's one Congolese achievement that I see on the list, and it looks kind of, I think this would be really difficult. City of Congo, playing as Congo, have a capital city with a population of 30. So, interesting.
Oh yeah, that's not the easiest one.
No, that's tough for sure. But like Wouter and I said before, we're not, you know, inherently achievement hunters, but since we started doing this Report Back, I think achievements are a fun way to kind of key your game in a specific direction too. And I'm looking at some of these really funny ones like Wat is Love, build Angkor Wat and a Wat in Angkor Wat. So I was thinking if we did Khmer this week, we could do that or something like that, but that would be later on down the road. There are some achievements that you can do, like the Raid Healer one with Guru, irrespective of what Civ you play. So keep an eye on those. And yeah, share your achievements, guys, with us on the subreddit as well, because that's always a fun way to angle your game. All right. What else? I think we're coming towards the end here, Wouter. What else do we need to talk about? Am I missing something?
We still have an email and, of course, the historical minute and strategy tip.
Great. Do you have the email up? Do you want to share it?
Yes.
Okay, please do.
We got an email through our email that you can all mail to with anything that you want to ask us or just want to tell us that you enjoyed or whatever. We always love positive, negative feedback. Give us anything and we will work with it. We got an email from Desmain and it says, good to have more Civ in my podcast feed and I enjoy the focus on a Civ. Often I set up a custom map when I play. Random map, leader, and AI, but I take out all of the AI but one or two before launch. Sometimes I boost city-state to compensate, sometimes I don't. Dealing with the enemy AIs is not really fun and safe for me, and I can focus on nation-building, exploring, wonder-building, and emissaries. There was a way to keep the AIs as friends, I might enjoy them more, but the inevitable betrayal puts a damper on things. I'm not sure if I like the rise and fall. The loyalty system makes things more tense and takes away from my fun empire building. I really miss the old ability to buy enemy cities though, and building my palace. Is there anything from past civilizations games that you'd like to see back? So he has a really specific type of playing the game, and I really like the empire building as well, so I can completely understand the way you play the game. I also do miss building my palace. Do you remember that from the old Civ games that every now and then you got to build another piece of your palace? I really like those kinds of stuff.
Yeah, that was fun. For me, it's pretty straightforward. The thing that I want from old games is a system of diplomacy, but I think like a diplomatic victory type and like a supranational organization, but I think that's coming, so I'm not too worried.
Yeah, the thing that I would like to see back most probably is in Civ 4 you had like your culture spreading and borders were fluid. In Civ 6 now you can flip cities by loyalty, but the city borders are still the city borders, so you flip the entire part. I really like the part of slowly creeping up with my cultural borders towards civilization and starving the city from hexes around, well in that case it was square still, around that city, and eventually like they're throwing over in a revolt, throwing their current ruler and just come to my empire. I really, really like the fluid border part, and I miss that. I understand it's maybe not the most historical part, but I want that back because it's so much fun to see. It gave me so much enjoyment.
Good. Yeah, is that something that you think they could bring back in a future expansion? It sounds like a pretty fundamental mechanic. I'm not sure that's something they'd alter.
I don't think they will. They have something like that with the cultural bomb from Poland, for example. Yeah. But I don't see that coming back in any way or form in this iteration of the Civ game.
Fair enough. Okay, let's get into our strategy and historical moments here, and we'll set the folks on their way to their Congolese games this week. So do you want to share your strategy tip first, please, sir?
Yes. So I focused up on religion on higher difficulty and everything like that, and I always keep reading on the Civ subreddit that people are having so much trouble with getting a religion on higher difficulty levels. Mm-hmm. I never get that problem. And I the reason why is, in my opinion, maybe a little bit easy, but I'm going to share the way that I do it, and hopefully some of you might actually get some use out of it. So what I always do is focus on astrology, the first thing that I do. If I found a natural wonder like I did in my Tamar game, that's awesome, just give me a couple of extra turns, but usually it's not necessary. You just get astrology and finish building whatever you are unless it's far away, and then start building on Holosite. Never go for Stonehenge. The AI is just too picky with going for Stonehenge, and you will just not make it. Beyond that, after your holy city is finished, you will gain one great profit point per turn, and at that point, considering normal settings and everything like that, it will still take 60 turns before you actually have a great profit, which in most cases can be too late to even get like the first great profit, or even like the later ones, because they become more expensive. So what I do is start Holy Site Prayers. Holy Site Prayers convert the production into faith and great profit points once finished. And doing that probably around twice will usually give me, if I'm lucky and somebody was slow with building Stonehenge, the first great profit. And if not, then it will at least get me pretty much towards the second great profit. And in that way, I've never failed in any deity game or whatsoever that I want to have a religion to get a religion. It costs a little bit out of you in the beginning of the game because you need to focus on the Holy Site Prayers, but it will pay back significantly later in the game because you have that religion. You have a little bit of extra fate already stored up, which also catapults you into a very early pantheon usually, and you get a better choice of which pantheon you want. And with all that going on, you're pretty much set up for a good game, even on higher difficulties, and able to win the religious game.
Good stuff. Stuff like that is super helpful, I think, especially on higher level, on Emperor, which is the level I play on. I find it's tough enough for me to get a profit. I was fortunate in this game that I guess my prioritization coupled with civs that weren't geared towards religion helped me, but I can't imagine on Immortal and Deity, and I always see those threats in the subreddit, people complaining about it. So listen to the man, folks. Listen to the Holy Righteous King Bouter. He will point you in the right direction. All right, my historical minute actually has to do with Tamar. So Tamar is a really, really cool historical figure that I admittedly don't know much about, but I did some research on her this week, and I was reading some really fantastic stories on her. And she ruled in the 12th century, and obviously this is a time when you would not have had many female rulers. This is pre-Queen Elizabeth in England. This is pre-really anybody in the Western world when it came to female rulers, and there had been some rulers in the Eastern world, female rulers, pardon me, in the Eastern world, but Georgia is neither west nor east, right? If you look at it on a map, Georgia is situated firmly in the center. So it's a country and a culture that's always been influenced by both the east and the west. And around Tamar's time, they were being heavily influenced by the dueling forces of the Byzantine church, which to them would be in the west, although we think of it as the east. And then the growing Muslim empires of Central Asia and the Middle East, which were also on her doorstep. So it was during Tamar's time period that, kind of like my boy Peter the Great, she had to make a choice as to whether she was going to gear the nation more towards the east or the west, or towards the Orthodox Church or towards Islam. And so she really kind of pointed Georgia on the direction towards their unique form of Christianity, their unique form of Orthodoxy. And it is actually a really unique form of Orthodoxy. And Tamar is very much canonized in Georgian culture and in the Georgian church. For the role that she played in making them a more, you know, godly country. If you listen to the song that constantly plays, the sort of monk chants, it's not monks, obviously, because it's they're Orthodox priests, so they would be not even chanting, really. It's just hymns. But these are songs about Tamar, and you can hear her name repeated, and I looked this up, and these are actual like tribute songs or tribute hymns that these priests put together for her back in the day that were sung at her death and that have been sung in the church at different points throughout its history. But my favorite story of Tamar is she did what I think most women would do to a deadbeat husband. Her first husband, a guy by the name of Yuri, was, let's just call him a clown. He was supposedly he was this really kind of like handsome, stereotypically strong fighter that she sought out specifically to marry as an effort to, she was basically forced into marrying someone. You need to produce heirs, you need to consolidate the throne. But after marrying Yuri, she realized that, you know, he was a goof. He was a mean drunk. He was constantly picking fights with her. He was, you know, sleeping with anybody he could manage to get in touch with. He was constantly trying to pull the country into war with its Muslim neighbors. And after a short period of time, she actually had enough with him. And she did something that's pretty unprecedented. She convinced the Eastern Orthodox Church in the 12th century to allow her to divorce this clown and send him off into exile in Constantinople. And I mean, understand that in the 12th century, that's akin to, I don't know, asking them to you know, allow you to fly to the moon. That's not something that the church was granting to any old, you know, Dick, Tom, and Harry. And she managed, of course, it helps that she was the queen and she was pretty well loved during her time, but she managed to convince them to allow her to grant a divorce, or to allow her to have a divorce and to send this idiot off into exile. And funny enough, she sent him to Constantinople, and he twice raised armies to try and send back to Tbilisi to conquer Georgia and to install himself as the ruler in these coup d'etats, I guess you could say. And both times she pretty easily and pretty summarily kicked his drunken ass back to Constantinople. And then she remarried a guy who was, for all intents and purposes, a much better husband, and she managed to have two heirs. But the key with Tamar is that she's someone that actually I can think in my history classes I'm going to start teaching a little bit more about, because she is a great example of almost an anachronistic female ruler at the time who just really ruled without a care for the opinions of anybody. I mean, she cared about the nobility and she cared about the church, but she did things that she thought were best for her people. She was really charitable. But she, you know, she took no guff, I guess you could say, from anybody. And the Georgian national epic, most of these countries, particularly countries with Orthodox influence, the countries in Central Asia have their epics, right? The epic Gilgamesh comes to mind for that. The Georgian national epic is called The Knight in the Panther's Skin. And it's actually about her, which is really, really cool, because usually these epics are about these, you know, Gilgamesh bro types, right? These big muscle-bound warrior types. But Tamar was a warrior. She may not have gone into battles herself, but she was, you know, a fantastic tactician. She was a strong ruler. And in the annals of, you know, kind of the legacy of the early female rulers of countries of the world, she is one, you know, to hold in high esteem, and her people hold her in high esteem. She is probably the patron saint of, you know, Orthodoxy in Georgia, and one of the key figures of their mythos. So a fascinating historical figure that, you know, deserves all the plaudits that she's got. And I'm frankly surprised it took Firaxis and Civ this long to get her into the game, because I know that they really have been trying to equalize with a lot of female rulers in the game, which is fantastic. And she is as badass as they come. So, yeah. Tamar.
Good story. I like it. She was badass.
Yeah, she was. She was great. So, all right, folks. That's going to bring us to the end of our episode. Wouter, any last thoughts? Anything you want to send the people off in the sunset with?
I want to send them off in the sunset with some extra... Well, nah, it doesn't work. Damn it. I was thinking maybe like for the next report back, they could found a cool religion and call it like Tamarism or something like that, but you can't.
That's a Congo. That would work with like literally anybody else. So that's a great idea, but not with Congo, unfortunately.
Dang it. Well, I blew it.
Next time, Tomorrowism will be true. It'd be really ironic, actually, to found a religion called Tomorrowism and get into like a religious fight tomorrow in your game. Like,
exactly.
You're worshiping me, but you want to take me over, but I don't want you to. What do I do? It would be crazy, man. All right. Get those report back games in, folks. It's Congo this week, and really win with any type of victory type you want to, frankly. It doesn't have to be cultural. You can go and do a nice science-based Congolese victory if you want. And then post in the subreddit, reddit.com/r/civcast, civcastpodcast@gmail.com if you want to send us an email. We're on Steam. I'm Haggis Hands. Yes, I know it's ridiculous. I'm trying to change it. And Voucher, your Steam handle is?
Innocentius.
Okay, perfect. Innocentius, right?
Yes.
Boom. Write that down, folks. And yeah, thanks for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed it. And until next time, in tribute to maybe my favorite quote in the entire game, Sydney is a 250-square-mile tiger trap made up on massive obelisks, riddled with jagged spears. And yes, they will catch your pretty face.